the Thursday, December 6, 2018 TAC committee meeting for AMAX. We'll start with the call to order. Do we have a quorum?
We do.
Thank you very much. And we will move into, and before we get started, I'd just like to remind everybody that if you make a motion and a second, please state your name clearly for the record. That way we can make sure we get it into the minutes properly. So with that, next we'll move into minutes for the September 13th, 2018 meeting. Mr. Chairman, any updates or anything for that?
No.
Okay, I'll entertain a motion.
Josh Kovacs can make a motion.
Okay, do I have a second?
Jim Bowling, second.
Thank you. We have a motion, we have a second. Any comments or questions? Hearing none, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. We will go into staff reports, financial progress report. Mr. Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you'll see on Attachment 3A, we've expended about 26% of the budget through October. We're about a third of the way through the fiscal year, so we are in very good shape. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Good. I will entertain a motion.
Jim Bowling, move to approve.
Thank you, Mr. Bowling.
Give me more a second.
Thank you, Mr. Bowling. Any comments or questions for Mr. Baker? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. And we'll go into technical progress report. Mr. Baker.
All right, thank you. So, as you know, we're finally through the election season, which is, I know, a great relief to all of us. One of the things that's been interesting is that there has been a little bit of discussion now that the House is controlled by the opposing party that there might be some wiggle room for an infrastructure bill, for a transportation infrastructure bill. Supposedly, Democrats are saying that's one of the things that they're willing to work with President Trump on. They're also saying things like they want it to be funded with real money, which I think assumes not borrowing it from others, but I'm not exactly sure on the term. One of the interesting things is the Transportation Infrastructure Committee of the House, which is one of the most prominent voice on transportation infrastructure from the federal level. That is now under control of the Democrats. So I think we're going to see some interesting movement there, or at least I hope so, in the coming months, and maybe, you know, as part of the next 2 years, we'll actually see infrastructure get off the back burner. From the state side, and Dave's going to get into this a little bit, the state's starting to evaluate looking out at 2020 and 2021, and what they're seeing is deficits primarily caused by the bonding of the turnpike. If you look at the pro forma that at least that we've seen, the debt service now from ODOT is getting larger as the payments are coming due on some of the bonds they put out. One of the cuts that is going to take place potentially is on some of AMAT's discretionary money, which it's not a large cut, but Dave will talk a little bit more about that. But I did want to put that in context, especially without the other thing about 2021 is it's also when the FAST Act disappears, our current transportation bill. So there's also uncertainty on what those federal amounts would be. And it's hard to predict any growth without a bill. so that's something that we're definitely going to be paying attention to here in the coming months as we discuss things with ODOT. And then finally, on a local side, AMATS right now, we're working on our bicycle and pedestrian plan, continuing to work on some of our planning data forecasts. We're also starting to look at our congestion plan, which, you know, typically I know a lot of you are all familiar with the, now I guess I'll call it old school, level of service congestion. And the reality is the feds are pushing us to look at travel time reliability, looking at free flow speed versus actual speed, data collected by cell phones. And so our newest analysis that we'll be working on is going to start to reflect that type of analysis. It's interesting. It's different. One of the things that we might even work with our committee is sort of deciding what is congestion to us, because unlike an ABC, the example would be if the free flow speed is 60 miles per hour and the peak time speed is 75% of that, you know, so cars are traveling at 45 miles per hour. What do we equate that to? Is that unacceptable in the world of AMATS, or is that acceptable, or is that, you know, warning but not horrible? And that's one of the things that we have to start to look at, because it's not going to be as simple as like a calculation with an LOS of, you know, hey, C's, you know, D's okay, but E's bad. And that's a big push from the feds, is this understanding that, you know, that congestion has a lot more to do, is perceived as being, you know, can I go the speed I want to go? Yeah, Paul.
So, Curtis, won't that directive kind of come from the Federal Highway Administration?
Well, what's great about being an MPO, and what's also sometimes a struggle, is that, you know, the way that they're sort of looking at it is like, look, you know, I-495 in D.C., you know, their reliability times are 39%. If they could get it up to 60% free, you know, if they could get that up.
So it's regionally.
Exactly. So they want the urban areas to kind of decide on their own sort of what do we think is unreasonable congestion.
So there's no set standard.
No, I mean, and there are some benchmarks out there, and we've seen what, yeah. Like Toledo identified every segment Toledo identified in their most recent plan, it was a 75% free flow speed threshold. So if it was under that, it was on the list, and it warranted additional consideration. You know, if it was 80% free flow in the peaks or at the midday peak or the morning peak, it was like that's not a concern. You know, 80% speeds are okay compared to free flow. So, you know, I think that's something that we have to look at, especially because, you know, our congestion isn't as bad, obviously, as Washington, D.C. or, you know, other places. But so I think it's a process that we would like to, you know, we're working on now to do some preliminary stuff, and we'll probably bring back in draft forms to the committee to take a look at. Dave, did you want to mention anything with that or at this time? Or?
No, I find it extremely interesting, mm-hmm. fascinating that this technology is available to us. As the one thing that I have to wonder about is the accuracy, but from some just preliminary experiments we've done, it seems to be pretty accurate. I'm still determining that, but it's just, to me, amazing technology. Yeah.
And one of the things to add is that, like, really what we'll be able to look at is the system that's the National Highway System Plus. So anything that's on the NHS system, which is not the same as the federally functionally classified system that we can fund, but that's the data that ODOT is, you know, has purchased and is providing for us, and the feds want us to use to analyze it. So the NHS system covers, you know, I think Paul, Arlington, Maslin, you know, Turkey, like some roads like that, but it doesn't get down to that level of depth. So we might still use the old system for some of our locations. But it really, like Dave said, is fascinating data. If you're interested in ever saying, like if you have an intersection you're interested in or a segment you're interested in, we can pull that data right now, and we've been looking at them, kind of looking at, you know, John and Streetsboro 14 is, I mean, those are free flow speeds under 60% at times, you know, that people are going half the speed limit or roughly. So there's some really good data out there that we'd be happy to work with you guys, but we're going to be rolling that out via our congestion management process that is our 4-year document. And from a technical side, we're trying to figure out where we think those thresholds should be and then bring them to our committees to take a look at. So if you have any interest or want to talk about it more, Dave or I have been playing with it. It is a pretty interesting concept. But and we might even maybe do a presentation to this committee at a later date as well, just to show you kind of the stuff that we're working with. But
cool. Yeah. Any other questions for Mr. Baker?
I guess I would just ask, are you considering maybe that the criteria is different based on the functional classification?
I think that could be a consideration as well, because, you know, obviously I think your interstate thresholds are going to be different than your arterial thresholds. And I think what would probably surprise maybe a lot of us, or maybe what I think would surprise the general public, is that how short these peak periods truly are. Like, the free flow speed is inhibited for a shorter time than I think I assume when, you know, as a driver, because when you hit it, it's like, that's terrible. That's the, you know, but really when you see the data, and, you know, for me, I looked at 303 and 91 and Hudson, and It's not as bad. It's a shorter period than people would lead you to believe by saying, oh, Hudson, you can't drive through there. Because we can get this data on 5-minute increments. So you can see every 5 minutes the change. And so you can almost narrow down your peak to a 20 or 30-minute period usually. So that's a good comment. I think we have to figure out, and then if it is for a 5 or 15-minute increment, does that, if it is for 15 minutes, let's say your free flow speed goes down 50%, does that 15 minutes warrant a $3 million investment or something like that? And I do think this is a good way for us to move forward on congestion. But I think we're all going to have to kind of have a learning curve, because I think when you guys come to us with stuff, we'll be saying, well, can we pull that up on the INREX data that shows us more of that real-time speed?
Good. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Baker. Moving on, the AMATS Federal Funds Report. Mr. Poulette.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't really have any news to report about projects being sold. There are a couple larger projects that are scheduled to sell this month, Cleveland-Maslin Road in Norton, and the citywide signal upgrade in Streetsboro. We had a project review meeting on November 9th at ODOT District 4. It was the lockdown meeting, and it was also an opportunity for AMATS to discuss moving some projects out, mostly resurfacing projects. And I tried to select projects based on PCR and based on ADT. Because if you had a resurfacing project that had a PCR of 53, I certainly didn't want to move something like that out. So we still have negative balances, and really in STBG we have negative balances almost every upcoming year so far. So. We still have to try to work on that, but sometimes corrections just happen on their own. So if you did have a project moved out, just please remember to keep working on it, trying to get it ready, and if funds do become available somehow, we will try to move it back up. And we'll also do that, based on the worst moved up first. In other funding news, Curtis did allude to this, that ODOT is beginning in 2021 planning to cut some of the discretionary funding that they give to us. I guess I should explain that our funding comes from, two pots of money. The one pot of money is based on formula. It's federal money that we receive based on population and miles of road and things like that, and that is not the one in jeopardy. ODOT goes above and beyond that, and gives us what's called discretionary funding. It's money that they give us, out of goodwill, and that is the money that beginning in 2021, they're going to cut, in 2021, they'll cut it 6%, and then each year after that, through 2025, it'll keep being cut. So it's, when it comes down to it, it's not a huge amount of money, but it's definitely not in the direction we want to go, and it's nothing unique to AMATS. They're doing it across the board. In fact, ODOT is cutting 14% of their own budget to try to compensate for the funding dilemma that they have. So it's nothing unique to AMATS. It's all the MPOs are being cut. So all I can say is I really hope that maybe a future transportation bill might somehow make up for it. And, if things do change, if the state does does become more solvent again, maybe they'll restore it. It's hard to say, but it's definitely not the direction we want to go. So, I really kind of hate to report that, but on the other hand, I wouldn't feel too alarmed either. If there's any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Any questions for Mr. Poulet? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Poulet. All right. Old business, Mr. Speaker?
No business.
All right. We'll move on to new business, the 3P public participation plan. Frager? Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Attachment 5A is our draft public participation plan, or 3P. This is an update of the plan that the Policy Committee approved back in 2015. Perhaps the most significant change in this update of our old 3P is the inclusion of Appendix E, which is our language assistance plan for limited English proficient populations, or the inclusion of an LEP. We decided to include an LEP based at the urging of Federal Highway Administration and Federal Transit Administration's officials following our federal certification review as an NPO back in early 2017. While the federal officials were generally impressed with our public outreach strategies and many of our innovations and such things as our Better Block events and our Bike and Brainstorm events, they urged us to include an LEP, as many other NPOs are doing across the country. What the LEP does is it outlines the strategies and approaches that we will take to accommodate those people for whom English is not their primary language. When we prepared this item, we followed four factors that were issued by the U.S. Department of Transportation. When developing this, we considered the number of LEP persons in the greater Akron area that are eligible or likely to be an encounter an AMATS-funded program, service, or activity. The second factor was the frequency that these folks will encounter an AMATS-funded program, service, or activity. And third, the importance of that, of such an activity or product to those populations. The fourth and final factor that we had to consider was the resources that are available to our agency and the cost to our agency in providing LEP assistance. As we developed our LEP, we began working on the draft 3P in late July, and as we developed the LEP, we decided to look at what other NPOs across the nation are doing. And we checked a variety of NPOs, from large ones such as the Houston, Galveston Area Council, to smaller ones such as the other AMATs, the Anchorage Metropolitan Area Transportation Study. We believe that our Appendix E, our LEP, complies with Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act and related Title VI regulations. We also are confident that it complies with Executive Order 13166, which was issued by then-President Clinton, that states that agencies such as ours must provide meaningful access to our goods and services for LEP persons. When we crafted the 3P and the LEP, we wanted them both to be living documents. And what I mean by that is we're not going to only limit ourselves to everything that's spelled out in these documents as the things that we're going to do to reach out to the public. We're going to look for ways to go beyond that. We're going to keep an eye out for what's working, what strategies are working in other councils of government or other NPOs and other local governments, and see if we can apply them to our own area. We will also be regularly monitoring the effectiveness of our 3P and hand-in-hand with our Citizens Involvement Committee. Another thing that we plan on doing in the future is we're going to be looking for opportunities to train the staff to better accommodate and meet the needs of LEP populations. So with that, the draft 3P was available for a 45-day comment period to the general public beginning on October the 12th to November the 26th. We promoted its availability, and the larger newspapers in our area, such as the Record Courier, the Beacon, and the Reporter newspaper, as well as various social media. This item will also be presented to our Citizens Involvement Committee tonight for review and comment. And we would like a recommendation from the TAC to the Policy Committee regarding the draft 3P. And if you have any questions or concerns, I'll do my best to answer them at this time.
I just have a question on what you're using to do the translation on the website. It says you're translating to Chinese, French, and Spanish because that's the higher population.
Mm-hmm.
What program or I'm working on my own test.
Oh,
six.
Yeah. we were just added. Google Translator was just added to our
VM. Okay, so that's what you guys are using to do.
I mean, I don't think it's 100% foolproof translating program, but I think it gets the basics. As you can imagine, there are MPOs, when we talk about different regions and different issues, as you can imagine, there are some regions where this is a really large issue, and so I think this is sort of like one of those things the Fed wants to make sure. And we do have a growing like Bhutanese population in North Akron. You know, so there are things that we want to try to get those types of people involved. The other thing Carrie didn't mention was just from a public participation plan perspective, it is, and you guys might know this, although obviously, if someone really hates something in their backyard, they're going to show up to a meeting. But to get somebody to come out for a 20-year plan is incredibly difficult. So, you know, we're always looking at ways other than just the public meeting to get people involved, because I believe the last one, we were all sitting in an empty room waiting for someone to show up and ask us questions. So that is one of the challenges for us, is just actually getting to the people and getting public comment.
And by the way, even though this largely deals with people who have limited English proficiency skills, we will provide other translation assistance for folks who have special needs. If we need to have someone that's versed in American Sign Language, we'll work to get that available to them.
But we have not had an LEP request of any kind in the 13 years I've been here. So.
Any other questions? Have there been any comments? You said since October, right?
I'm sad to report, no, there haven't been. So I take that as to mean people are so enthralled with the report that they're pleased with it, and it took their breath away.
Right, absolutely.
Can I make a comment?
Certainly, ma'am.
Just from a Spanish-speaking side of things, as a fluent Spanish-speaker native from Puerto Rico, Google Translate is not that good.
Right, right.
Yeah, you guys are going to have some issues in someone that's
going
to learn it for actually helping
with
the process.
Right.
If you need my help with that.
Appreciate it.
What do you suggest?
Huh?
Well, what do you suggest as a translation software?
A human.
Oh, you mean in terms of the actual meetings. I thought you meant in terms of the website.
There's a lot of glitches in those software, so they don't really translate the sentences and the like.
Right, it's almost just like word replace word
exactly.
Kind of thing.
And it's not. So it's difficult for a Spanish-speaking person, especially if they're very limited on the English, mm-hmm. to actually get the sense of what you're trying to convey.
Yeah, there's a lot of things they say backwards, too.
Yes.
Or we say
them
backwards.
May I get your name, Adam, for the record?
Jesse Medina.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Hearing none, I'll entertain a motion.
Any more, so moved.
Second?
Captain Bajic, second.
Thank you. Having a motion and a second, any other comments, questions? Hearing none, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Move on to the 2015-2017 traffic crash report. Mr. Poulet.
Hey, thank you. Today I'll be presenting the 2015-2017 traffic report. Some of you are probably wondering, why did I put that old car on there? I guess what led me to that was I saw this, I think it was on Facebook, I saw this picture of a baby seat from 1950s. And I just couldn't believe how crude it was. It looked like a shopping basket. And then it got me thinking of how the older cars, how a lot of people rave about the older cars, but they definitely didn't have the safety features that we have now. I mean, I guarantee you,
those people didn't have airbags or seat belts, or most of the time the kids were probably in the back, and it was just a whole lot different back then, especially for safety. So today I'm going to, during my presentation, we're going to look at some trends. Now, this year, I'm going to present kind of a new concept where we don't just look at, like, crashes. We look at crashes and the resulting injuries or fatalities. There was a crash nearby here this week. The crash itself was one event, but there were four fatalities that resulted in that crash. We're also going to discuss high crash sections and intersections, bicycle and pedestrian safety, safety performance measures, which is a new federal requirement, and then we'll briefly touch on the ODOT safety program. Looking at crashes, just pure crashes, we're relatively stable. The 2015 was up a little bit, 16 down a little bit, and then 17 was up again a little bit. And this red line up here is thousands of daily vehicle miles traveled. And I'm not sure why we had this dip. I get this information from ODOT, but it's kind of funny how the crashes dipped and the vehicle miles traveled dipped in 16. I'm just not sure why, and then it kind of rebounded in 17. If you would draw a trend line on this graph, for those of you are familiar with trend lines, it's kind of gives you what's happening over a long period of time. The trend line would be you would have a slight positive slope, but it's as you can see over the past 10 years, it's almost flat. Looking at injuries, we're doing better with injury crashes and injuries decreased in 2017. Once again, this number here is the number of crashes, and then this number is the number of injuries. So you can have one crash, a crash is an event, but you could have four or five injuries result from that crash. Here's something else we're starting to look at more. It's not just injuries, but serious injuries. Once again, we're doing better. It's decreasing the crashes, and the resulting serious injuries have decreased over the past 3 years, so that's good news. Unfortunately, this is the area that got a little bit worse, the fatalities. Crashes and fatalities, unfortunately, have been going up. And it's not something unique to our area. It's happening statewide and I think nationwide. So far, I think 2018, which I don't have the data for yet, I think 2018 is a little bit better. Just briefly how we analyze the crashes. We download the data from ODOT, and it's all GIS-based now. We plot the crashes, and that sounds easy, but we do a lot of checking. We do a lot of checking because we found that some crashes are simply plotted in the wrong location. Freeway interchanges are confusing. A lot of times we have to sort out what happens at ramps and what happens on the main line. And then we have to kind of try to figure out if it's an intersection or a non-intersection crash. Generally, whenever a crash happens within 250 feet of an intersection, it's considered intersection-related, but not necessarily, because
it could be a crash that had nothing to do with the intersection. The high crash criteria for sections is 10 crashes per mile per year and a minimum crash rate of 1. And for intersections, it's 10 crashes in the 3-year period and also a crash rate of 1. Then we rank the intersections. We use a composite score, which takes into account not only number of crashes, but also severity of the crash, and the crash rate, which takes into account the traffic. And then after the composite score is calculated, then we rank them. So we had 179 highway sections that met the minimum criteria. I'm not going to go over those because that's in Table 5.1 of your memo. One of the highest ones was State Route 59 in Kent. I truly believe it's kind of the perfect storm because over the last 3 years, I believe that section had a lot more traffic on it because Summit Street was closed. And you also have a lot of young drivers and just a lot of activity. And I feel very confident that I know that Kent is aware of that segment, and I think there's actually a study that's going to happen in the near future. We had 316 intersections that made the list. Something a little unique about this list was intersections ranked 1 and 2 were right next to each other in Akron. It was South Maple and Rose and South Maple and Cedar. One thing you don't see on an aerial view is topography. This is a hill. This is actually a pretty steep hill. And I briefly looked at the crash reports. It made mention of a lot of red light running. I'm not sure why, but it just a lot of the crashes were a result of red light lines. Freeways are done by ODOT. I don't actually personally analyze freeways. They divide them up into rural and urban, and what they do is they take a tenth mile section and analyze it. And it's really hard to describe some of the sections because it could be just in the middle of nowhere. So what we did was we made a map. I think 10 freeway sections made the list in our area, and they are mapped on map 5-3. And I did want to mention that we did have one freeway section that was ranked 7th in the whole state, and that was State Route 8 near Glenville. And I think that I noticed that in the mornings going southbound, that's usually where traffic kind of slows down, and it's probably a lot of rear-end crashes. Moving on to bikes and pedestrians, these crashes have some unique characteristics. They have a real high percentage of injuries. You don't have any protection on a bike against a vehicle or if you're a pedestrian. 79% and 83%. Respectively. They're more random and spread out. It's hard to say they all happen at this intersection or on that section. We do have those mapped, and if you look at the maps, you can see the only conclusion that I can come up with is they're kind of proportional to the population. The denser the population, the more of these you might have. Many involve younger people, and especially younger people may not be aware of the rules they need to follow. And this is one, I believe, where education is a very effective countermeasure. So looking at the last 3 years, we had a little spike here. I'm not sure why, but we had 14 more bike crashes. But the good news is we didn't have any fatalities in 17. So once again, you can see over the years it goes up and down, so hopefully in 18 it'll go back down. One more thing with bike safety, the 3-foot rule went into effect last year. House Bill 154 introduced that. I'm not sure how that can be enforced, but it's definitely a tool that is definitely that can help bikers. And it, I think if nothing else, it makes people aware that, look, we got to give them some room. The most 66% of bike crashes happen at intersections. Over the years, I've been looking at bike crashes a lot, and I've tried to categorize them into about, I think I have like 25 or 30 different categories. Here's the top three intersection crashes. The bike many times blows through a stop sign or a red light and is hit by the car. But then 30 of those happen, but then the opposite happens also. The bike hits the car. And with this crash, it could be either one at fault, either one that doesn't stop when they're supposed to. And then at intersections, many times cars turn in front of bikes. And a lot of these happen because they just don't, the car just doesn't see the bike. It's a very, it doesn't have much profile, and it's just, it's hard to see. The other crashes that happen on the three most common non-intersection crashes with bikes is backing out or pulling into a driveway. I know myself many times, I think we're all sometimes in a hurry, we back out and really don't look like we should. We look for traffic, but not for bikes and pedestrians. And then bikes getting hit from the back, and then side swipes. Pedestrian crashes have gone down, so that's good news. But unfortunately, fatalities have gone up by two. Pedestrian crashes have been going down now the last 3 years. But once again, just like bikes, it's the traffic crash graph was relatively smooth, but bikes and pedestrians seem to jump up and down quite a bit. We noticed that traditionally most of the pedestrian crashes happen in October, and I took a closer look at that. I thought, is it because of Halloween? Are people out? Are kids out toward the end of the month? And I didn't find that. I just found it just happens all month long. And the only conclusion I can come up with for this spike right here is school starting and the days are shorter and the time, especially in the mornings, are dark because we don't change time now till November. But the only conclusion I have is you just have the weather's nice, there's more people out, and the days are shorter. And it's really hard to see pedestrians at night. Most pedestrians have dark clothing on, and it's so hard to see kids, and especially kids at night when they're out on the street. Safety performance measures. This is a new federal requirement. We have to look at number of fatalities, fatalities per 100 million vehicle miles, number of serious injuries, and then serious injuries per 100 vehicle miles traveled, and then number of non-motorized fatalities and serious injuries. And what we do is we have a five-year average. We started with a base five-year average, and every year we do another 5 years and compare that 5 years to our base. And unfortunately, measures didn't go the direction we wanted them to go. Fatalities and fatalities per 100 million vehicle miles actually went up. But number of serious injuries per 100 million vehicle miles traveled went down, and then number of non-motorized fatalities and serious injuries went down. So we did okay in three of them, but unfortunately, we didn't do too well with fatalities. And like I mentioned earlier,
It's nothing unique to us. I think it's just statewide and nationwide fatalities haven't been going in the right direction. The ODOT safety program, very briefly, most of you are familiar with this. I think we're very fortunate to probably be engineers or government workers in that in one of the best states in the country, I feel, for safety. We have Ohio has a very robust safety program. There's over $100 million now that's available for safety projects, and applications are due April 30th and September 30th. So, if there's if there's locations on this crash report that you're interested in, you could possibly apply in April. And another thing, most of our matches are 20% with safety money. It's 10%. It's really a good deal. Couple of things I discovered as I was analyzing crashes. This is just some, I call this section et cetera. It's just some things I wanted to show you. I've always wanted to graph the age of licensed drivers in Summit and Portage counties with the age of driver one. Now, in our crash reports, driver one is usually the driver at fault. And I honestly couldn't check every crash report, but I just took it at face value. And because of the huge difference in numbers, what I had to do was convert everything to percentages. So as you can see, the 20 to 24-year-old drivers have the most accidents. And going back to our number one section in Kent, those are a lot of 20 and 24-year-olds there by the campus. Then when we, once again, the red is the age of the drivers and crashes, and the blue is age of licensed drivers. Then when we get out toward 35, 39, it starts to kind of level off. In fact, actually, then things look a little better. And what I found interesting was out here, with older drivers, there's a lot of news about senior drivers, but being bad drivers. But I'm just not seeing it. In fact, there weren't really as many as I thought there would be. I thought that there'd be a higher percentage of people in this age range. So that's just something I thought was interesting. I wanted to show you. And then, when I was looking for this data, I want to show you another discovery I made. Once again, the green bars are age of drivers in Ohio. The blue bars are age of drivers in Summit and Portage counties. And the red bars are age of drivers in the U.S., all by percentages. And as you can see, Ohio and the U.S. kind of peaks in this age range, say 35 to 44. Look where Summit and Portage County drivers peak. They peak out here. So what this graph tells me is the senior tsunami, which people talk about, is going to hit us a little before it hits the rest of the country. So I just that doesn't really have anything to do with safety. I just thought that was but it kind of does in a way, because this is going to keep moving out, and eventually we will have more elderly drivers, and that affects your signage and your pavement markers and things like that also. So, including 17, crash-wise wasn't too bad. Unfortunately, fatality-wise it was. All the locations are eligible for safety funding. The locations will be sorted by community on our website, because I know everyone's interested in their own community, so you can go to our website and you'll find it sorted by community. But it won't be posted until after it's approved next week, next Thursday at the policy meeting. And if you have any locations, even if it's not on the list, that you'd like to talk to us about, we'd be glad to, you know, try to help you. And there's one more thing I wanted to mention. At the end of the report, I have some school bus diagrams about the type of roads and when you should stop and when you don't need to. Every now and then, there's something in the news that really I feel really bad about. And a couple, I think it was a month or so ago, maybe 6 weeks ago, there was an accident that happened where three kids were killed because a car didn't stop for a school bus. And these three kids were all from the same family. And I just couldn't imagine. I mean, they lost, that family lost all their children in this accident. And it was because a car didn't stop. And I know on a two-lane road, it's pretty, you know, it's kind of a no-brainer. You have to stop. But I drive on Market Street and on urban streets a lot, and it seems to be a lot of confusion on what to do. Like, sometimes on four-lane roads, some cars stop, some don't. And I don't know. I just threw that in because I just think it's good to know, because I just see a lot of confusion on urban streets on how to handle a school bus. So that concludes my presentation. If there's any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Any questions for Mr. Poulet? Hearing none, I will entertain a motion.
Jim Ball, move to approve.
Thank you. Second?
Second, Jim Kushner.
Thank you. Having a first and a second, any comments, questions? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. We'll move on to resolutions. Resolution 2018-21, Mr. Poulet.
Okay, attachment 6A is Amendment 13 to the current TIP. This amendment adds three new projects, revises the funding to one existing project, and cancels one existing project. The first project that we're adding is Medina Line Road. What I'm showing here is there's always some confusion on roads that are on a county line. So when these Medina Line Road resurfacing projects started coming in, the communities that along Medina Line Road agreed to split up the maintenance of those roads. So what we didn't want to have was this community doing this half and this community doing this half, or funding this half and funding this half, because it involves another ODOT district and it involves another MPO. So this is kind of how we split it up, where Norton has it from Easter to Greenwich, and then Medina County maintains it from Greenwich up to Ridgewood, and then Summit County maintains it from Ridgewood north. So the project we're adding is this piece right here. We're funding it with $381,700, and its construction scheduled in 2020. Next project we're adding is a Boston Mills Road study, a geotechnical study. This is actually up in the park, and it's using federal funding called Public Lands Access Program Funds. This is just a study to determine how to utilize it. The next new project is in Akron. This is the Main Street Corridor, Phase 2. Phase 1 is currently under construction, and the section we're adding is just north of that. We'll go from Mill up to 59. The next project is just a funding revision. We're adding 3,263,000 of CMAC funding to the Cleveland-Massillon Road project in Fairlawn. Now, this CMAC funding was actually approved back in December, and it was my intent to just add this new funding when I developed the new TIP, but now the TIP development has been delayed a year, so we're adding it through this amendment. But this was actually approved. The funding itself was actually approved back in December of 17. And last but not least is the cancellation of a project in Hudson. It's an intersection project at 303 and 91. The council decided they didn't want to pursue this, and the money that was supposed to be that was allocated for it, almost $1.8 million, is just going to be used to just go. We're not losing it to Columbus or anything. It will just be used toward the debt that we have in 20 and 21. If there's any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Any questions for Mr. Flynn? Hearing none, I'll entertain a motion.
Jim Ballin, move to approve.
Have a second?
Yield.
Okay. So I have a motion and a second. Any comments, questions? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Other business, the 2019 AMATS meeting calendar, Mr. Baker.
Yeah, so in the back of your packet, the 2019 AMATS meeting calendar are looking for approval, but if you take note, similar calendar to what we've been doing the last few years, the annual meeting is scheduled on the 11th of October, so mark your calendars accordingly. Right now, our hope is to continue to be in this space. We have not yet confirmed with the Hilton whether or not they can house us on each of these dates. So if there are any issues, we will let you know. But our assumption, the leading assumption, is that we will be here next year. And we'll be sure to let you know the minute we get that confirmed. But with that, we're hoping for an approval of the calendar.
Very good. I'll entertain a motion.
John Trubb, so moved.
Thank you. Do I have a second?
John Trubb, second.
Thank you. Any comments or questions about the calendar for 2019? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Report of the 2019 nominating committee. The last meeting, we had Mr. Withey and Mr. Collins were the nominating committee. And we'd like Mr. Collins to tell us what you guys have come up with.
Speaking with the other nominating committee members, we decided to make a motion to reappoint the current chair.
Okay. Any comments or questions or updates on that, Mr. Baker, regarding what policy has done?
No, policy is going to be made. Well, actually, in the last meeting, policy decided to maintain their slate for a second year, and they actually approved it. In our last policy committee meeting. So this would be in keeping with what policy committee did at the end of last meeting for them. And we just think that it really provides value to have the same chair and vice chair for a two-year term. It kind of gives them more, we have six meetings a year. So I think, I know Joe's not the greatest chairman, but, he moves the meetings along.
That's the goal.
So we think it's a good plan to keep moving in that direction.
So with that, any questions for the nominating committee or for Mr. Baker? Hearing none, I'll entertain a motion.
Jim Ballin, move to approve.
Second, John Trubb.
Okay. I have a motion and a second. Any further comments or questions? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Okay, motion carries. Anything else, Mr. Baker?
No. No other.
Very good. Then I will entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Very good. Do I have a second?
Second, Jim Kushner.
Thank you. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And motion carries, and officially we will adjourn at 2:24 p.m.